So it should be okay. Okay, so again, we're starting out slowly and hopefully introductory for most of you. And the computer is not in the most convenient place, so I'm going to have to kind of step in front of it sometimes as I'm scrolling. But in an introductory way, basically what biochemistry is the study of the reactions of life. So it's basically like organic chemistry was the study of carbon and its reactions. This is the study of what goes on in the human body. The cells we'll concentrate on will be human cells. And there's a few major people scientists who helped create the field or started the field of biochemistry. And I've listed a couple, and of course there are many, many more. What do you need? And some of the major players are Frederick Wohler. He was a chemist, a biochemist that synthesized urea. And urea was considered at that time, back when he synthesized it, an organic compound, which meant to people and scientists at the time that it came from something living. Of course, we know now that's not true. In fact, urea is a compound that contains carbon and nitrogen, and it's actually the compound in which our bodies excrete waste nitrogen. It comes from the urea cycle. But he was able to synthesize it in the lab, which was kind of for them like he created life, because they considered it a living compound. And so that is when they kind of started to make the distinction between organic chemistry and biochemistry, and realized that organic did not mean something necessarily that was living, but instead something that related to the study of the reactions and molecules in the body. Buchner, beyond the Buchner funnel, which you've all seen in organic chemistry, identified enzymes, and we're going to talk a lot about enzymes, as biological catalysts. And they work in the same way as a catalyst that you would see in first year chemistry or an organic chemistry lab, and that is they lower the energy of activation in a reaction, thus speeding it up. They're not consumed in the reaction. And he basically did this by making alcohol. So he basically fermented sugar with yeast, live yeast cells, and he ended up with alcohol and carbon dioxide, and he was able to show then that the yeast actually acted as a catalyst in making alcohol. So he figured that out and related it. Emil Fischer, Fischer diagram, something you've probably seen also in organic chemistry. He took the enzyme thing a step further and realized through his studies that enzymes are very specific. They're both specific for the substrate that they bind, the reactant, and they're also very reaction specific. So only a certain molecule will react with a certain enzyme. And that makes sense biochemically, because everything needs to be very exact and within very narrow ranges. And then, of course, Watson and Crick, it was just the big anniversary of the discovery of the structure of DNA. There was a lot of publications on that and things. Amazon.com had a big thing on their website about it, and so on. So Watson and Crick discovered the spiral, basically the three-dimensional structure, the helix of DNA. And genetics is a part of biochemistry, and then of course you know it's separated off into its own field where you can actually study just genetics. So beginning again introductory, the chemistry of life, looking at the first table, we call it the elements of life. And basically the major players, similar to organic chemistry, are carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. So if you took a human body and freeze-dried it, the percent dry weight in abundance, the first is carbon, then oxygen, then hydrogen. And primarily, it's carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen that make up proteins, carbohydrates, DNA, RNA, lipids, and heme. And these are all molecules we'll talk about, classes of molecules that are important to biochemistry. The fourth one comes in is nitrogen. There's quite a bit of nitrogen. Again, not too much of a surprise. Found in proteins, DNA, RNA, and heme. And then we get into the ones that are a bit more obscure. Calcium is fairly high on the list, again, because it's the main component of bone. So calcium basically forms with phosphate to form bones, and we know we have a lot of bone. Phosphorus, pretty much part of the backbone of DNA and RNA. Also part of bones. Again, it is the counter ion for the positively charged calcium, and those two come together and create bone. Also, some lipids contain phosphorus, and lipids are an important part of membranes, which we will see. Electrolytes, potassium, sodium, chloride, all things you're pretty familiar with. Find them in Gatorade. Sulfur is found in proteins, particularly in two amino acids, which we'll talk about, cysteine and methionine. And then you see magnesium and iron. Magnesium is getting, the amount is getting less. Iron, it's really getting towards a trace element. Iron, though, makes the top list here because it is found in heme, and we're going to talk a lot about heme as an important molecule because it's actually heme that binds oxygen and hemoglobin and oxygenates our tissues, and we will talk about that. So again, the most abundant carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen, and they compose the majority of the compounds that are important in biochemistry, and that's the four classes of compounds: proteins, carbohydrates, nucleic acids, and lipids. And we're going to talk about each of those in some detail. We're going to introduce them today. Proteins are basically polymers of amino acids, and we'll talk about that in great detail. Again, today is meant to be introductory. Enzymes are also proteins, which we'll talk about. Carbohydrates are sugars, simple and complex. Nucleic acids, of course, are the building blocks of DNA, and we will get a little bit into some genetics this semester of how the bases come together to make DNA and RNA. And lipids, which includes fat or fatty acids, which are the things we eat, are the main components of membranes, so cell membranes and cell walls. Again, as you look at them, you can see the composition is primarily carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, some nitrogen, and some phosphorus. And again, those two amino acids and proteins contain sulfur. And again, you can look at their roles, and you will notice also that lipids, carbohydrates, and proteins are also fuels. And we know that because we eat them. We derive nutrient from them, and we will talk a bit about nutrition and talk about carbohydrates, lipids, and proteins as nutrients. So beyond being part of membranes, as lipids are, carbohydrates are also important for cell-cell recognition. We'll talk about that as well. And proteins are part of our tissue, our structure, also fuels and enzymes. And we all know DNA, RNA are how we store genetic information. A little tiny review on bonding. Probably haven't seen a lot about bonding since first year chemistry. Touched on it in organic chemistry. But just to kind of review, basically in our minds, the difference between covalent and ionic bonding. So in this table, we have the main players, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. We have the number of electrons that complete their outer shell, and the number of unpaired electrons, which is equal to the number of bonds that can be formed by these atoms. And again, pretty much review, you've definitely seen all of these players in organic chemistry. And the most important part on the far part is the relative electronegativity of these atoms. And we know that hydrogen, carbon, and nitrogen are not terribly electronegative, but oxygen, as compared to those three, is quite highly electronegative. So that, of course, affects the chemistry, the bonding, that oxygen undergoes. So we're going to mainly, pretty much 100% exclusively, be talking about covalent bonds, because that's what's going to be important biochemically. Ionic bonds are really not going to be important in most biochemical molecules. So of course, covalent bonds are the structural framework of our four classes: proteins, carbohydrates, lipids, nucleic acids. And oxygen is going to be important. And again, it's important because of its electronegativity and its high attraction for electrons. So it possesses, of course, a partial negative charge. And that makes it something we've all heard, polar. It's a polar compound. And the three compounds that you see there are examples of covalent bonds, things you've seen. Methane, you saw as a basic hydrocarbon, not going to be important biochemically, but you saw it in organic chemistry. Water, we're going to talk about a lot. That's mainly composed of water, going to be an important solvent. And there's ammonia. And ammonia itself won't be that important biochemically. However, the amine and amide groups will be. So we will see nitrogen as amines and as amides. Now just to contrast that and for a review, you remember an ionic bond is quite different than a covalent bond. A covalent bond is a sharing of electrons. An ionic bond is something between two ions. It's kind of a static attraction between two different charges. And you will notice in ionic bonds, they're really formed because of differences in electronegativity. So in other words, severe or vast differences. So in other words, sodium and potassium being positive, positively charged ions, and chlorine being negative, they come together to form what we call an ionic bond. And you remember that most ionic compounds, and the best example, of course, is sodium chloride, separate and exist as ions in water. So of course, water being primarily the solvent we're talking about biochemically, we're composed primarily of water. Any of these compounds we will not find as compounds, but instead as ions. So we will talk about them as ions. So when you eat salt, sodium chloride, drink Gatorade, which has potassium also in it, all of those things, they are ions, they're electrolytes, and they're going to be part of the electrochemical gradient that we'll talk about. So they drift apart in polar solvents like water. And again, here's three examples, sodium chloride, potassium chloride, calcium chloride, and we will see all of those ions at different times. There's our major player, and we know it's water. There's oxygen carrying its partial negative charge, great attraction for electrons, got two hydrogens attached to it, and it forms basically this kind of triangular shape. And water is going to be important biochemically for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons is hydrogen bonding. Water is capable of hydrogen bonding, and it's capable of hydrogen bonding to several things, including the simplest thing, itself. So water forms hydrogen bonds to itself. And it's because of this that water has a certain cohesion, a certain surface tension that allows water to kind of avoid vaporization. So it's a resistance to vaporization. And that's very good, since we're mainly composed of water and we obviously don't want to vaporize. So water does not really easily vaporize because of the surface tension, and that's caused by all of these water molecules hydrogen bonding to themselves. Water, of course, is also the solvent, if you will, for all of the biomolecules that we're going to talk about. So everything we talk about is in a water environment. Water dissolves ionic compounds, which we just said, like sodium and chloride, turns them into two ions. And water can also form hydrogen bonds with other polar compounds, such as ammonia. And there's an example of water hydrogen bonding with ammonia. Now there's some definitions when we talk about polar compounds, and we talk about things liking or not liking water. And those definitions are hydrophobic and hydrophilic, and we will use them a lot in biochemistry. And something that is hydrophobic is water fearing. It doesn't like water, it doesn't like to be around water. Fats are a good example of that. You all know if you take oil and mix it with water and shake it up, it will not dissolve. It forms droplets. It's hydrophobic. It fears water. Any kind of long chain hydrocarbon fits in that category. Hydrophilic things like water, and they like to be in contact with water. And those are compounds that are polar and ionic and lots of electrons, lots of electronegativity. They like water. They hydrogen bond with water. And we call those hydrophilic or water loving. So hydrophilic and hydrophobic. Organic chemistry is a requirement for biochemistry, and we're going to very briefly review the functional groups that we will see over and over and over again in biomolecules. Hopefully they're all going to be very familiar. The first is the hydroxyl group. You remember the hydroxyl group. We will see lots of hydroxyl groups, and they'll play an important role in a lot of biochemistry. Ketone functionality, aldehyde functionality, so carbons double bonded to oxygen, we'll see lots of those. And carboxylic acids. Carboxylic acids are going to be the weak acid, and we're going to talk about acid-base chemistry, the weak acid that we will find as a biochemical acid. The amino group, that's going to be a weak base. We're going to find lots of amino groups. And then as a review, there's the amide group. Remember, an amide is a carbon double bonded to an oxygen that's bonded to an amine group, an NH2. We're going to see lots of amide bonds because amide bonds have another name in biochemistry. They're called peptide bonds. We're going to see them when we talk about proteins. Then last on the list there is phosphoric acid. And the only reason phosphoric acid is on there is because phosphate groups are also going to be very important to a lot of biomolecules. So we're going to see a lot of things are phosphorylated, contain phosphoric acid derivatives, phosphate groups on them. So that's just a review. What does a phosphate look like? Now most of the biomolecules we talk about will not be hydrophobic or hydrophilic, but they will be something we call amphiphilic. Amphiphilic. And it's a big word, but it simply means it is a compound that is both water-loving and water-fearing. So it is both hydrophilic and hydrophobic. And there's an example of one there, and that is basically a fatty acid. And you see it has a long hydrocarbon chain. And that long hydrocarbon chain is going to be hydrophobic. But yet, down here on the end, it has some oxygen. It has, in fact, a carboxylic acid group. And the carboxylic acid group is going to be hydrophilic. So it's both hydrophobic and hydrophilic. And this combination is going to be really important. Cells. Again, this should be hopefully very introductory. Basically, we're composed of cells. That's going to be the basic unit. So everything we're going to talk about is going to refer to eukaryotic cells. So these are cells with a prominent nucleus, more complex, of course, than prokaryotic cells, which are smaller, usually single-celled things like bacteria. We won't really be talking about E. coli, good example, prokaryotic, lacks a nucleus, has a nucleoid region, much simpler than a eukaryotic cell. Eukaryotic cells include plants, animals, and fungi. We'll concentrate mainly on mammals. And in the cell, just as a kind of quick overview, the nucleus is the control center, kind of like the computer. It's where the DNA is, so it's where genetic information is stored. That's where replication, transcription, translation, all of that occur in the nucleus of the cell. The endoplasmic reticulum is important in biochemistry because it's where proteins are synthesized and exported. There are also a lot of enzyme systems involved in the metabolism of lipids. And we actually will not get into the metabolism of lipids this semester. That'll be next semester. But many of the enzymes for lipid metabolism are in the ER. The Golgi apparatus is where proteins are modified, sorted, packed, and transported. So kind of like a UPS for proteins. They're made, then they go to the Golgi, and they're packed, packaged, modified, and moved out. Mitochondria, really central role in oxidative energy metabolism. So we're going to see all of our energy basically has to do with the mitochondria, and we will get to that later. Chloroplasts, we won't worry about because that's part of plants. Of course, chloroplasts are where photosynthesis occurs, so that's how plants get energy. And though they are eukaryotic, we're not going to really talk about plants. The mitochondrial matrix, we're going to talk a lot about. The inner mitochondrial membrane and the matrix have a lot of the enzymes that we're going to see in aerobic energy metabolism. And as you look through your syllabus, you will see we're going to talk in quite a bit of detail about aerobic energy metabolism. That's the metabolism of all of our different carbohydrates, glucose, fructose, galactose, and all of the pathways associated with metabolizing, gaining, or deriving energy. Again, this is just a picture of the thing we said in words. And then just for interest, and not at all, do not memorize this or worry about this table at all, but just for your interest, you can look through it. It's kind of fun. It gives some of the trace elements in lesser amounts, and what they do, and some of the consequences of deficiency of some of these things are interesting. For instance, calcium in children, rickets, in adults, contributes to osteoporosis, something we've all heard about. So as you look through the table, you'll see some kind of interesting relationships, functions of the different elements. And again, most of these are trace elements, things that we'll find in very, very small amounts in the human body. But again, the key players, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, we'll throw in nitrogen, then a little bit lesser, phosphorus and sulfur are the key players. So again, tables just for interest. not to worry. So again, hopefully all so far introductory, probably things we've heard in a biology class at the least. Again, the four major classes, and we're going to introduce each class now, and then we'll split it out, and if you look at the syllabus, talk about each in some detail as we move through the semester. Again, lipids, membrane structure, fuel, fuel storage, carbohydrates, fuel, fuel storage, and cell-cell recognition. Proteins are enzymes. They are important structurally, and they're also fuel. And of course, nucleic acids are DNA, RNA. That's where we store all of our genetic information. So starting with the first class, which is lipids. Lipids are soluble only in nonpolar, apolar, hydrophobic solvents. And we've all kind of experienced that in the lab. We can take a fat or a lipid and we can dissolve it in hexane or acetone or some sort of organic solvent, but we can't dissolve it in water. Ester bonds are important when we talk about lipids because fatty acids, which are the things we eat from our diet, fats, fatty acids, are stored in our body as triglycerides or triacylglycerols. Same thing, different word, triglyceride. Triacylglycerol. And the way that fatty acids are stored is through ester bonds. So basically, there is a compound. The first example there is just simple ester formation. You'll remember lasso chemistry. You basically take out a water and you form this carbon, double bonded to oxygen, bonded to oxygen, the ester functionality, eliminate water. And there's a molecule, abundant, glycerol. Simple molecule, three carbons, three hydroxyl groups. And it is to glycerol that fatty acids bind through ester bonds. And again, the example is palmitic acid. So if you eat something containing palm oils, tropical oils, palmitic acid, fatty acids, they will form ester bonds with glycerol. And this is how the body stores fats as triglycerides or triacylglycerols. It makes also some diacylglycerol, but they are not the primary storage form for fatty acids. So again, ester formation. Another thing you'll notice about this compound is it's pretty amphiphilic. Again, you've got long hydrocarbon tails that are very hydrophobic, and you've got a bit of polarity in amongst these oxygens where you can have some hydrogen bonding and are more hydrophilic, water-loving, hydrophobic, water-hating. A variation of a triglyceride or triacylglycerol is a phospholipid. And phospholipids are incredibly important because they are basically what make up most of our membranes. And by membranes, we're talking about cell walls and also the walls, the borders inside cells are all made of membranes. And we're going to have a whole time where we talk just about membranes. And so basically the only difference between a phosphoester or a phospholipid and a triglyceride is that last position on glycerol, instead of picking up a third fatty acid, picks up a phosphate group. A phosphate group. So there's our phosphoric acid again. We showed it in the beginning. Again, we eliminate water and we add a phosphate group. Now what this does, and here's our representative phospholipid, is it is adding a large polar head to this molecule so that when we look at it now, we can really clearly see these long hydrocarbon chains, which will be very hydrophobic or water-fearing. And now we have a lot of polarity added here, a lot of electronegativity. This will be very hydrophilic or water-loving. So that makes this compound extremely amphiphilic. This is a cartoon drawing of the same compound. It's easier to draw shorthand. This is the polar head group, the hydrophilic part, and this is the hydrophobic tail part. And now if we take a bunch of these and stack them up, basically we get a lipid bilayer. It's like a micelle, and that's what a membrane is. So that's a cell wall. That's a barrier. It's a lipid bilayer, a membrane. And again, the driving force is this hydrophobicity that's causing this to form. And again, what it is all these tails don't like water, and so they like to come together, like attracting like, to exclude water. And again, like attracting like, the outside head groups, which are very polar, like to stay out on the outside and be in contact with water where they can hydrogen bond with water. So again, biologically speaking, or biochemistry speaking, biological membranes are formed mainly of phospholipids. Another class of lipids that's always thrown in when we talk about the broad class in biochemistry of lipids is sterols. They don't really fit anywhere else. That's part of why they fall in here. And this is a drawing of cholesterol. As you look at it, it is amphiphilic. They're not as obviously as, say, a phospholipid. But mainly the structure is hydrocarbon. It's got rings. And this would be hydrophobic in nature. But it always has this hydroxyl group, which is hydrophilic. So it's basically an amphiphilic molecule. So it somewhat fits in with the concept. So we throw it in with lipids. And we will not actually look at cholesterol this semester. It'll be next semester. Next semester, we'll see the synthesis of cholesterol and how it is used to make all of our steroid hormones. So cholesterol is a very important molecule biochemically. It's where we get all of the other steroids in our bodies, our steroid hormones, sex steroid hormones. All of those hormones come from cholesterol. And again, that'll be next semester. So, and again, next semester's lectures are on there as well. If you want to look ahead at any of those things, you can click to the website and see them. Big class, carbohydrates. Major fuel for most of the world's population. Carbohydrates, sugars. Sugars are very water soluble. Again, we know this through experience. If we take a glass and we put some sugar in it and we add water to it and we stir it, the sugar will dissolve very readily. We can actually put a lot of sugar in a small amount of water and it will still dissolve. This is a simple sugar. This is actually glucose, D-glucose, and you can see it both in its open chain and in its ring form. And you don't need to know to memorize the structures. We will see this again and talk about it in great detail. Again, right now we're doing introductory things. But the thing to notice about a carbohydrate is it is very, very, very hydrophilic. It really likes water. It's got lots of hydroxyl groups and can participate in a lot of hydrogen bonding. And this is a little picture where here's all the little waters coming in and hydrogen bonding to all of the hydroxyl groups. So sugars. Again, they feed most of the world's population. We eat them regularly and we store them for use for fuel later. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about glycogen and metabolizing sugars later in the semester. Proteins, which we're going to get to quite quickly, it won't actually be next week, it'll be the week after, are polymers of amino acids. We're going to study the 20 natural amino acids and how they come together to make proteins. Enzymes, all enzymes, which are biological catalysts, are proteins, and so therefore proteins are important. They also make up a lot of our structural framework, and of course they also give us energy. We eat proteins and digest proteins, so we will discuss them in great detail. Nucleic acids, we will cover them later in an introductory way. They're covered very thoroughly, of course, in genetics courses. We'll talk about the bases, the five bases, and how they pair, how they're made, purines and pyrimidines, how DNA is made, how mutations are corrected, how RNA is made, how we get codes, code is written, codons are produced to produce proteins. We'll talk about all of that later in the course. So nucleic acids, again, it's one of the classes of biomolecules, and it's where we store all of our genetic information. So introduction again, and we're going to take apart and look at a much closer look at each of these four classes as we move through the semester. But before we do that, we're going to talk a bit longer about water. Again, our biological solvent, everything we're going to talk about, all of our biomolecules, that's our solvent. That's what's there. That's what's around. That's our environment, water. And for biochemists, we can consider water very loosely as an acid. And again, very loosely the definition being of an acid, that it can shed or give up a proton. However, this happens very, 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 very infrequently. So when we look at water, we would consider very, very weak, 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 weak acid. Only about one water molecule in 500 million is actually ionized at any given time. But when we look at it this way, we can do a quick calculation. and we can take that 500 million and divide it by the molar concentration of water, which is in pure water about 55. And from that is where we get our definitions, which you've all seen before, which is the log of the hydrogen ion concentration, also the log of the hydroxide ion concentration is minus log of 10 to the minus 7th, or 7 is the pH of pure water. And again, you've all seen this. And if you multiply those two together, 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 7, you get 10 to the minus 14. With that, you can calculate all different hydrogen ion concentrations and hydroxide ion concentrations, which we won't do, because that doesn't overly interest biochemists, but something you probably saw in first year chemistry. So pH of pure water, 7. Our water pH, not anywhere near 7. If we took the tap water from Los Angeles and measured the pH, we would probably find it to be either very high or very, very low, depending on a given day, but not anywhere near 7. Now, acids. We've all seen acids. We've all dealt with acids. Strong acids such as HCl, which ionize very easily and are almost always found in an ionized form, are very strong. They're not going to be important biochemically, too strong. The kind of acids that are going to be important biochemically will be carboxylic acids. And carboxylic acids are degrees much, much, much weaker acids than something like HCl. So basically the difference in electronegativity between the hydrogen ion and an oxygen ion is less than that between, say, hydrogen and chloride ion. Not as dramatic. So carboxylic acids give up a proton. They are acids, but they do it less frequently than something that's strong like HCl. So basically biochemists have developed a way to look at biochemically important acids such as carboxylic acids. And the way we do that is to talk about their pKa, which is basically a measure of strength, acid strength. And what pKa is by definition, we call it convention, is the pH at which the acid is half protonated and half deprotonated. That's the pKa. So if you take any given acid, and our example here is acetic acid, again, acetic acid is stronger than most of the biological acids that we'll see. Even though we know it's vinegar, it's a quite weak acid, particularly if we compare it to, say, HCl or nitric acid or sulfuric acid, acetic acid. It's still pretty strong biochemically. But it is a carboxylic acid, and it has the ability to ionize. In other words, this hydrogen ion comes off and leaves us with an acetate ion, with this negatively charged acetate ion. And it has a pKa, as does every carboxylic acid associated with it. pKa of acetic acid happens to be 4.8. What that means is that at pH of 4.8, we will find exactly half of the acetic acid as acetate ion and half as acetic acid. So half ionized, half deionized. So half of it will be protonated and half deprotonated at pH 4.8. And that's how we derive that pKa. There are tables full of pKa's for all myriad of acids and carboxylic acids. You don't need to memorize any of those or know any specific pKa's. As we work with them, or if they're on an exam or a quiz, I will give you the pKa so that you will have it. But instead, we need to be able to look at ionization curves. And ionization curves are basically the result of doing a titration. And this is something you will do in the biochemistry lab this semester in 451. You will actually take an amino acid and titrate it and make one of these titration curves. And if you remember doing titrations from first year chemistry, you basically had an acid or a base in a beaker and you dissolved it in some solvent. Then you put either an acid or base, depending on what was in the beaker, in your biurette, that very volumetric piece of equipment where you could read very accurately different volumes. So in this case, we have an acid. We've dissolved it in our beaker. We've added some kind of indicator in the lab, like phenolphthalein, something that'll turn color. And then we start dripping in base. And so as we do that, we move from a low pH, or something that's very acidic, to a high pH, or something that's very basic. Very basic. So again, remember, low pH, low numbers, is very acidic solution. Lots of hydrogen ions around, and everything is protonated. So notice our acetic acid is pretty much 100% in its protonated form at low pHs. As we add this base, drip, drip, drip through our biuret, we're going to come to a point where we have it exactly half. So half of it will be protonated, half of it will be ionized or deprotonated. That's the pKa. And again, for acetic acid, it falls at about 4.8. That's where we start to see the color change as we're doing the titration. It begins to be pink. Okay, you've reached your end point. You've reached your end point. Again, you'll actually do this in the lab. As you continue then to add base, the pH rises, and finally becomes quite basic. At that point, we have pretty much 100% of the acetic acid is ionized or deprotonated. Deprotonated. That's an ionization curve. Again, the results in the lab of doing a titration on something. A general way that we can describe all weak acids, and again, that's all we're talking about is weak acids, is we can say the acid, HA, goes to the conjugate acid and the conjugate base, or A minus and H plus. And again, pKa, and each one has a different one, and it's dependent on the electronegativity of the particular A group in that acid. And I'll always give those to you. Now, if we're at pH values other than pKa, that one's easy, because at that one, we're exactly 50% protonated, 50% deprotonated. But at other pHs, all along that curve, we have some kind of ratio, or some kind of mixture of the acid protonated and deprotonated, or ionized or deionized. And we actually have an equation that we can use to calculate at any given time along the curve how much is ionized and how much is deionized. And that's called the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, named after a couple of, obviously, scientists named Henderson and Hasselbalch. And that equation is that the pH is equal to the pKa plus the log of the concentration of A minus over HA. And basically, we can use this, and you will do that also in the lab, the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, to calculate, again, amounts, concentrations of ionized versus deionized or protonated versus deprotonated acid all along the curve. And we can prove that this equation fits our definition of pKa, because remember, we define pKa as the pH at which we are exactly half protonated, half deprotonated. If we plug that in here, we know pH equals pKa, and if we are at that exact value where we're halfway, pH equals pKa, then this log value is going to be 50 over 50, or the log of 0, which is 1. So basically our equation works, it fits our definition, and again we can use it, plug numbers into it, to find out amounts of conjugate base or acid all along this curve. And again, we're not going to actually do that in the lecture. I won't ask you to do that in the exam, not to play with the numbers, but to understand the concept is all we want to do here. In the lab, you'll actually play with numbers and do a titration similar to this. So that's the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. We can display it, and more importantly, concentrate on the graphs of the ionization curves. We can display these things graphically. And there's basically some rules that fall out of this as we look at this graph. And that is, if we are more than a pH unit below the pKa, so we're in the acid region, we're in low pHs, lots of hydrogen ions around, we're at a low pH, then we're going to find that most of the acid molecules are protonated. Okay? So when we're a pH unit below the pKa, in the case of acetic acid, we're talking anything below 3.8, we're going to find mostly protonated molecules. Notice that a protonated carboxylic acid has no charge. The charge on that molecule is 0. If we find ourselves somewhere on the curve where we're one or more pH units above the pKa, so in the case of acetic acid, above 5.8, up in the basic region, the acid will be primarily ionized. Notice that when a carboxylic acid ionizes, it takes on a negative charge. So most of the molecules will be negatively charged. Now, if we are within one unit of the pKa, so between 3.8 and 5.8 for acetic acid, we are in the region we call the buffering zone. That's the buffered region. And you probably remember talking fairly endlessly about buffers in first year chemistry. That's the buffer region, and that's where it resists changes in pH. resist changes in pH, the buffering region. That's going to be really important on Wednesday because we're going to talk about conditions, biochemical conditions, physiological conditions known as acidosis and alkalosis. So it's going to be important for us to understand buffering in a biological sense and understand pKa's. Now, the last little rule, of course, falls out and makes sense that if we're more than or less than, if we are within one pH unit, then we've got partial charge. So it won't be all negative charge, all negative one charge, or all zero charge, but somewhere in between there. But again, the important concepts are the very low pH. Put in your mind now, everything's protonated. The acid is protonated and carries a zero charge. At very high pHs, everything is very basic. The acid is ionized and it carries a negative charge. Now, on Wednesday when we come together after the holiday, we're going to do this exact same talk, but we're going to talk about biological bases, amine groups. And we're going to see that there's a little bit of a difference in an amine group at low and high pHs. And we're going to discuss pKa as it relates to bases. And again, then we're going to go on from there and go into acidosis, alkalosis. So again, we're not going to play with numbers. We're going to just try to get concepts. Acid-base chemistry, hopefully review for most of you. So that's all of our introductory material. Make sure that if you did not do a little blue quiz, you give me some kind of piece of paper with your name on it. People have still been wandering in. I need to know who's here.